Hi, my name is Jason Hall. I'm the president of AMCO, or the American Master Chef's Order. Some history on AMCO. It was formed in 2014 by a group of master chefs, including Bill Franklin, who spearheaded this concept. The idea was to look at the brand, see how we can further develop it and develop the exam going forward to meet ever-changing needs within the industry, to offer a coming together of our guild once you've passed the exam on the other side, and then also to start to develop the training and support needed for candidates as they approach the exam. Our mission is to promote, sustain, and perfect our craft, all while identifying and supporting and inspiring the next generation of candidates as they progress towards becoming an American Master Chef. You can reach us and see more information on our website at AmericanMasterChefsOrder.org. Thank you.
Welcome to episode 9 of the American Master Chef's Order podcast. We're here today with two representatives of the Colorado Wool Growers Association, and we'd like to welcome to the show. I'll let them introduce themselves.
I'm Spence Rule, a lamb feeder from Brush, Colorado. I've been in the sheep business nearly all my life. And I guess Mike Harper and I will be the two that are with you today.
Really excited for our conversation today regarding American lamb and some of the challenges that they're facing in the current times.
Well, the Colorado Wool Growers Association is our state organization, and it consists of members all across the United States and all across the state of Colorado, of which Spence and I deal with directly on an annual basis and have had for many, many years, both of our families. And what goes on in terms of what funds the Colorado Wool Growers Association would be checkoff dollars on Colorado lamb, you know, in the state of Colorado. So there's some checkoff funds that are collected, and then we, within the state, we as members and the board get to decide how and where that funding is spent to promote Colorado lamb. And we both are and have been active in that organization for many years.
Fantastic. And so how did you and Spence come to meet?
Spence, you might fill in. Our families have been in the business for forever, and it's a pretty small business. So just through the organization and knowing everybody in the business, it's hard not to know everybody that's involved. Does that make sense?
Okay. My questions are, how large is a ranch? You know, how many head of sheep would you have on a particular ranch?
Spence, why don't you take that side?
Okay. I think in Colorado the numbers will range anywhere from 10 to 15 head of ewes on a real small flock on up to as much as 7,000 to 10,000 ewes in a large flock on the western slope. So there's a huge range. We have lost several of the bigger producers over the last several years, but we're still continue to have a good number of people that run between 3,000 to 7,000 ewes that are mostly located on the western slope and or, you know, southern Wyoming, Utah, that area that still belong to our organization.
So how have you all been impacted by, you know, COVID-19?
Well, I think COVID-19 could not have hit the sheep industry at a worse time. We hit right during the Easter time, which is normally our by far largest time of year for sales. It hit the restaurant trade, which again is probably the largest portion of our sales. So it hit the restaurants and the Easter time all at one time and just killed demand for, I suppose, what, 2-3 weeks, Mike. But then we did pick back up some of our retail business because people were forced to eat at home, and the beef and the pork industry have been a little bit short in getting their product to the market. So I think that's helped a little bit on the East Coast with our retail demand.
One of the problems that stems from this major slowdown is the fact that we have to continue to feed our livestock whether we have a market or not. So that being said, if you've got lambs that are ready for market at Easter time, and Easter is shut down because of COVID-19, you're forced to continue to feed your inventory, and what happens is you end up feeding into a heavier weight category, which in the long run becomes a discount because of the weight factor. And at times this time of year, we're dealing with old crop inventory, so age becomes an issue as well. So all at once, on top of a very depressed market because of lack of movement, you've got additional discounts for age and weight on top of it. So it's really put a bind on the market, on the pricing structure for us.
What is your average weight that you generally take your head of sheep right now? For if you were going to market, let's say COVID was not here, what would be the size of that particular animal when you take it?
Well, our personal goal would be to target around 155-pound fat lamb. And there are times that's fairly easy to achieve and attain, and then there's times when you get backed up where it's awfully tough to maintain those kinds of weights. It would depend on your volume movement. If you've got good movement, it's a lot easier to stay current. If you're not moving through your inventory, they don't stop gaining. Now, we try to maintain and hold our lambs as best we can on a high roughage diet so they don't get over fat. But these animals, they're going to continue to grow, and you have to feed them. So that's the rub, I guess. Spence, you might have other thoughts, but that's where I would be.
No, I agree wholeheartedly with you, Mike, that's the target weight, 155. I think there's other things that enter into it, too, that, you know, would be more outside of Colorado, or the genetics, and some of the farm flock lambs tend not to go quite to the same weights that our western range sheep do because of the genetics we have. We allow for a bigger carcass and a lamb that doesn't finish at as light a weight as some of the Midwest lambs do. But for our area, Colorado lamb, I would say our target weight would be 155 as a market ready lamb.
How long does it take to reach that particular weight, you know, from birth to 155 pounds?
Go ahead, Spence.
I guess if you're running at peak performance and you're pushing a lamb as hard as you can, a lot of these lambs we can have harvested at 5.5 to 6.5 months of age. The problem with the sheep industry, as Mike was alluding to earlier, is we lamb basically once, sometimes twice a year, so we have to maintain and carry an inventory out further into the marketing process, and we can have lambs on feed as much as 7, 8, 9 months, 10 months of age. And right now we're right bumping up against a year on some of these lambs. So, but ideally, if you're between 5.5 to 7.5, 8 months old, you're doing a pretty good job of getting them marketed.
So can you slow the maturation by the control of the feed or no? I mean, I'm just talking about for a month or so, or is it a constant, continuous, consistent feeding?
Well, the maturation is age-based, right, Spence? I mean,
okay.
Yes. Yeah.
And I tell people that, you know, if you've got stressful conditions, severe weather conditions or anything, inclement conditions of any kind, it's no different than a human. If you're suffering, you're going to age quicker. And so weather plays a big factor. So is it huge in the long run? No, but 1 or 2 or 3 weeks makes a big difference if you've had rougher conditions. And we're here in the West, you know, the sun shines 300 plus days a year easily, and we don't typically fight the weather too often. So we don't deal with a lot of shed space. We're kind of out in the open. And so we're exposed to weather conditions when they do come along, and that can have an effect on maturation. But for the most part, you start getting up towards 12 months or even 14 months, you're going to start showing up with a lot more yearlings. And that's the discount category that I'm talking about.
Yeah, thank you. This is Jason. What do you see as some of the challenges ahead as we continue through this kind of uncertain time as far as your industry goes and supplying ours?
I think there's an awful lot of challenges we have ahead of us. It's going to start at the production end, because as we come in, particularly into the Colorado season, we haven't had COVID-19 affect the Colorado lamb crop on the producer's side at this point yet. It's coming into that time. Those lambs will start to be marketed and sold here in September, August, September. So if we don't see a change in the market before then, it's going to affect the producers pretty dramatically and very tough economically. So we could stand to lose some of our production side if things don't change around. On the feeding side of the business, which is the next step, Mike and I and the other people that are in this thing have really taken a butt kicking here over the last 3.5 months. We've had lambs change from a market value of as high as $1.70 going into this thing and drop back clear back into the 80 cent range. So, you know, we've basically lost over half the value of the lamb that we've had on inventory and have all the feed in. So the feeding industry is going to take a pretty good butt kicking through this thing here. The packing side of the industry, I think, is still okay. We've had some real tough times in the state of Colorado with the plants that we have in operation with breakdowns and different things that have happened there. One of our major plants has had a bankruptcy over the last couple of months here. So the packing side of the industry, as we are about to get into, we're only a couple of months from opening the plant together, Mike and I and the Raftopoulos family. And we're going to be into that thing here real shortly. So we'll let you know a little more about that in about 6 months.
Okay. A question on that too, is now when you're taking it from a 6 month and then you go to a yearling, you know, that means the size of the, you know, the chops, the size of the legs and everything else are going to be, you know, larger. Is that one of the inhibiting factors for the restaurants that now the cuts of meat, your primals are a little bit larger, and that's what impacts that, you know, that $1.10 drop in cost per pound?
I don't think that the $1.10 is a fact of age or anything at this point. It's the inability to get lambs sold is what we've had the problem with now. We're just now starting to come into the yearling deal. The month of May, June, July is when we'll hit the big yearling problems, and then those lambs will mostly be harvested and we'll be out of it and start fresh again. But the size does change the longer you have lambs on feed, there's no doubt. And the fat thickness changes if you put them on a real hot ration versus a roughage ration like Mike was talking about. If you can carry them on a roughage ration, you can maintain and the quality and the fat thickness pretty good. And really our quality stays good. But the yearling designation, again, is just simply a fact of age and sex. Ewe lambs will hard bone faster than wethers will. So there's several factors, the weather and stuff like that Mike was talking about. A male versus a female. Female actually or naturally matures faster than a male, no matter whether you leave them as an intact male or you weather them. So the ewe lambs are the first ones to hard bone, and they become yearlings first, and then the wethers come after that. So that's the main thing on the yearling designation. It's simply just a maturation deal, and there's nothing you can do to change that on feed.
So do you see a huge trickle down, I don't want to say damage, but do you see some long-term impact, negative impact on the feed industry and then some of the other supporting industries for the lamb industry?
Okay. I do see some problems at this as far as we go, particularly in the feeding industry. There's going to be a lot of feeders across the United States that just will not be in business again next year. It's as simple as that. They've got lambs now that they can't even get a bid on. They can't get them sold. And as those lambs get bigger and bigger and losses, you know, get over $100 a head, if you've got, you know, 10,000 lambs on feed, you're $1 million loss. And there's a lot of these lamb feeders that we just can't stand that. So I think there'll be some real impact on the lamb feeding business. Hopefully we're back in shape. We've got this thing opened up, the restaurants moving again, and in time that the production industry other than California won't see much of a problem in their marketing chain. California is the only spring lambs that are being marketed right now, and they're taking it a pretty tough beating. Their lambs went from a $2 a pound down to a $1 a pound on these feeder lambs. So those guys are taking a pretty tough dump on them.
Yeah, this is Tony. Do you notice is there a major difference in the flavor between, you know, a 6 month and a yearling when they start to mature?
Tony, the only way I know the answer to this is we've run several trials, and there is a difference in flavor, some difference in flavor, but a lot of the people prefer the yearlings over the lambs, and it's just all a personal deal. It's like anything else. Some people acquire a taste for one thing and some acquire for another. The only reason we've, in my opinion, the only reason we have the yearling denotation in the industry is just to continue not to let these lambs get old. So there's a discount point. You have to set the number somewhere. We set that based on the break joint and on the front leg. If when you pop that break joint, if it breaks, it's a lamb. If it spools, it's not a lamb. So you had to have something to denote lamb from yearlings, and that's why that date is set.
I got you.
But not a great difference. The quality is not a great difference in quality, in my opinion.
Size difference, what would it be from 150 to what would a yearling generally go at poundage?
A lot of times yearlings will only weigh 150, but you know they as if the genetics are good on them and you keep feeding in front of them, you can have some of these lambs get up weighing 180 to 200 pounds. Still be yield grade 3s, 4s, some yield grade 5s, but you know the genetics, as we continue to improve on those, the size can get big. The longer you feed them, the bigger they get.
If I remember correctly from our earlier conversation, you're preparing to open a processing facility. I'd like for you to talk about that a little bit, but if you could also focus on, I guess, you know, maybe how some new regulations will be changing as far as social distancing and, you know, the staff that you'll have in your processing facilities.
Mike back yet?
Yeah, I'm sorry, guys. My phone heated up and it just died. Sorry, I am back on. I'm sorry. That I missed out on it. But you're going to let me answer this tough question, and that's uncharted territory. You know, the packing industries, as you guys know, have been suffering because you bring a lot of people in. You might have your staff might be a family of 5 or 6, and then you could have groupings of more than that living in an apartment situation. You don't know, and I think that's where a lot of this infection is coming from, and it's traveling amongst everybody at these plants. The challenge will be to monitor your staff coming in. I think what we've talked about already is daily temperature monitoring. Anybody coming through that front door is tested, and if they have a temperature, they have to turn around and go home. And that's the first step. Distancing in the plant, I think initially for us, it's going to be a slow startup, so you're not going to have the volume of people on the floor at full capacity because you won't be there yet. The challenge will be when you have enough business to man it completely, then it probably is a bigger challenge to keep that distance and keep everybody safe. But I think it starts with making sure that your staff is feeling good when they come to work and try to maintain that.
We had a very interesting phone call last week of just the recent podcast that went up, and they were talking about he's from a school, MasterChef Loving. He's at a school in Michigan, and they just picked up a FLIR thermal imaging device to take the temperature of students as they come and go in and out of the building. And it keeps a record, a facial recognition record for, you know, for the students and things like that. So, yeah, I mean, it's like we're talking about, it's unprecedented times. And I think everybody's starting to get a little creative and realizing that they're going to have to be creative.
Well, that again, uncharted territory, but you've got to be thinking about it. I don't know that things are not going to switch back to normal overnight. There's no question about that. And you're just going to have to be very diligent in the way you look at things and approach things. And safety is of the utmost importance. I mean, you just cannot afford to be responsible. If we're going to be responsible, we have to look out for these people. We have to be diligent in our testing and just going to have to stay on top of things. So it's going to be challenging, but we don't have any choice but to be up for it.
But, you know, one of the things that, I know I have my preference, and I'd like to discuss with you, what are the benefits of the American lamb over imported?
Flavor profile, 10,000 miles fresher.
That's a well, that's very well put, because it is every bit of 10,000. You know, I totally agree with you on, you know, on flavor. There's also, and I, you know, this is, you know, personal preference too, but I find the American, you know, it's got a pleasing taste. Sometimes I'll get into some of those from, you know, way down under, and they have a tendency of being a little bit more gritty in texture, and I can pick out the flavors right away. They're a lot stronger in flavor, and I really enjoy that. You know, that flavor profile that we get from the American Colorado lamb.
I'd really like to probe the question why is it that if American lamb is 10,000 miles fresher, why is it so much more expensive than imported lamb?
Well, in a feeding program, it costs money. And the thing about our business, what Spence and I are doing, is you're talking about taking animals off of the mountain ranges in the western United States in the fall of the year. As the feed starts to dry up high, you bring the sheep down, the lambs are sorted off, green feed becomes non-existent. So we're forced to gather up and put these animals on some sort of a feeding program. We don't have green grass to go to in November. It's going away. So that's why we were forced over the years. The pasture situation dried up. It's not there. So we're forced to lock these animals up and provide feed to them. And that comes at a cost. It costs real money to gather up these feedstuffs, mix a well-balanced ration, and feed these animals through the winter months, and continue to strive to provide the right kind of product to the consumer 52 weeks out of the year. And that's why feeding's necessary in the United States.
Makes sense to me. I love American lamb. It's definitely a preference of mine. So,
and the feeding is what changes that flavor profile that you and Mike were just talking about a few minutes ago, versus grass versus corn-fed, whether it be beef, lamb, didn't matter what it is. That's what changes the flavor.
Or how is that, if you can?
I think, and this is a personal opinion, but I think grass and sagebrush and different things, browse, the stuff that the lambs feed on out in the, when they're just running out on green grass, it just develops a different flavor in the lamb. When you feed corn or any type of a grain, it makes the lamb a little more fat, a little more marbling in the product, and it just changes the flavor profile. You agree, Mike?
Absolutely. Your grass feeding to me is really earthy, and I think that's where you get, to me, the gamey flavor out of grass fed. That's the way I see it. When you feed a mixed ration with a kind of a grain based diet, it's a milder. To Spence's point, you get a little more marbling, and that flavor comes through that meat, and it just, to me, gives it a milder, more pleasing taste.
And it seems to me that, grain or corn fed, the relationship of Americans with beef, and specifically corn and grain fed beef, it would make sense to me that palate would translate to lamb in a similar way as well.
I would agree 100%.
This is Jason. So what are some points you think would make a difference for the food service professionals out there? Any suggestions? I mean, obviously we need to, push this usage of lamb out there, but is there any suggestions or pointers that we can share with our listeners?
I think the flavor profile is a huge point to drive home to people, is to get them to try it. And I'm not saying that there aren't people out there that are going to enjoy the grass-fed flavor more. There are, I'm sure. But if you're pushing a quality product, which I think we produce, and you really stress the flavor profile, albeit it might be more expensive, in the end, I think if that experience is elevated, they'll find that the difference in price is worth it.
And Jason, another thing I think too is, I think people need to learn that don't be afraid of the lamb. It's very, very easy to prepare. It's a simple meat to put together. You can put a lot of stuff on it and put a lot of different herbs and spices, but if just salt and pepper and a grill, you can make a hell of a lamb chop. There's no two ways about it.
Absolutely.
You know, you bring out a really, really good point, and I think that's, when you look at the exposure, even with you know, some chefs, and even in the retail market too, what really goes or what those cuts that they can identify with, like, you know, a lamb chop or loin chops. But, you know, you've got some really great flavors when it comes into one of my favorite dishes are lamb shanks. You know, I just, you know, braised lamb shank to me, I mean, as chefs, I mean, if you go out, anything that comes up, if you're going to have a dish and it's braised, you're going to go for it. But a braised lamb shank, in my opinion, and warm bread, you can't beat it. But, I mean, leg of lamb is another great way of, you know, great product too. So, you know, I just now it in some of the things that we're looking at is what are ways that we can expose, you know, the food service industry and, you know, and even in retail, some of those other cuts of meat like legs and shanks and so on that can really become, you know, a great entree item on anyone's menu.
The challenge is kind of put in you guys' court on the food service side that understand that the advantages to the different cuts and the different, you know, like you say, braising the shanks, if people don't think about it. The push kind of comes from you guys out on the front lines. And the best thing we can have in a relationship with you guys is the ability to say, hey, guys, we're having, as an industry, we're struggling with lamb loins. We're struggling with loins because the importers have come in and they own 60% of our market, and they've got loins out there extremely cheap, and we've been backed up on loins for almost 2 years. And you guys are in a position to number one, push these other chefs towards domestic lamb and push them towards lamb chops. It's the bargain right now. You should jump on domestic lamb chops. The industry needs the help. They're a great product. Use your resources and create some recipes and get these things on the menu, and it'll help the entire domestic industry.
You know, you bring out a really good point, and here's one of the things that, you know, that I've done in the past. You know, yes, you've got one particular cut that may be going a little bit more expensive than another. And one of the things that I've done in the past is then you combine, you know, maybe a higher priced per pound item along with the lower priced. And it's almost like, you know, a mixture. Maybe you're combining two different cuts, but you can help to balance that main food cost so that you can at least bring your cost in line and also give a variety to your guest, which is, you know, something that's, you know, really top of mind with many of them. I, you know, when I teach at the Culinary Institute also, and I have a class, and I'll say nobody likes 18 bites of the same thing on a single plate. So if I could put a variety, like two different cuts of, you know, lamb on the plate, there's another opportunity, variety and flavor. And also one means of balancing my food cost so that I can at least get a profitable food cost and also a selling price that'll be pleasing to my customers.
So would you say that your typical rack of lamb users would be more open to a cheaper cut as we move back to some sense of normalcy?
The way that most restaurants are surviving, and especially country clubs, is with their to-go business. And, you know, if you look at a rack of lamb, a grilled rack of lamb, it just doesn't travel well to the home environment. And I think as restaurants come back, you're going to start to see lamb back on the menus, but that's all dine-in stuff. So your secondary cuts, I think a braise takes out really, really well. Lamb neck takes out beautifully. Lamb shoulder takes out gorgeous. You know, what are those things that could contribute to making, you know, to making it home as a great representative of what it is? And I think that would be my answer to your question.
Absolutely. I see the exact same thing. I mean, especially, you know, where there's still a lot of creativity within the market is the country club business, because they have that captive audience. And, you know, those who we've spoken to, they've seen an increase in sales in most cases, because they have members who aren't leaving. Their members aren't traveling to their other club. They're not, going on vacation. So their numbers, which normally had peaks and valleys throughout points in the year, their numbers are in some ways, up in F&B, whereas they've dropped off completely in other departments. And, they're still trying to create an experience with their menus, even though they're doing to-go food. So since they have the same repeat customers every single day, you in a country club, you're feeding the same families multiple times a day in some cases, whereas restaurants are a different animal. You have people come and go, so your variety is fine in some cases. The country club chefs are having to be even more creative than they had to prior, and I think that like Jerry said, they're the ones who are going to be pushing different specials and possibly even moving into other food types that they can keep that fresh and keep their members satisfied and trying new things. One of the chefs that we interviewed actually said that he's seen a higher sale on specials than he has when they were fully open, because people were at home and they're willing to try new and creative things, and he's able to market those things differently. So I definitely think there's an area there for them to push different cuts, for sure.
Totally agree. One of the questions that helps us out in the foods industry too is the accessibility of the product. Are they in all distribution networks like the Sysco's of the world, U.S. Food Service? Another one is Restaurant Depot. Is the Colorado lamb available through those particular types of companies?
I don't have a good feel for that, guys. You guys would see or have access to that better than I would. I say we're open to, our goal is to get product where somebody will utilize it. So, this step of this plant that Spence and myself and the Raftopoulos family are moving towards is to try to get another step further down the road to getting this product out to more and more people. So it's a step. We may at one point have to think about breaking these carcasses down in different cuts and moving those directions that you're talking about. But that's the ultimate goal, is to get it in you guys' hands and just get it to the general public if we can.
I think that's a start. That would work out really well.
So are there any other thoughts you gentlemen would like to share, or how can we as a restaurant industry help you more?
One thing, guys, that would help us, and this is no joke, we talk about fresh American lamb, is it, how common is it when the restaurant trade buys lamb for them to pop it in the freezer?
Very common.
What would help us, because if you were to ask me what the biggest challenge for me as a lamb feeder is, it's to provide the right consistent product 52 weeks out of the year. We're extremely seasonal on when we get our inventory, and it's a big challenge to maintain that quality. One way to maintain that quality would be to put it up, harvest it at the right weights consistently, and freeze it at the right stage. So the biggest thing that would help would be to have a frozen program of some sort.
Well, I can say that, not a source of pride, but at the, my last place of business, right? We had budgets that I had to stick to, and I would, as much as I wanted to buy American lamb, that wasn't necessarily always a possibility for me. I just couldn't put it on the plate and charge appropriately for it. And I can tell you that all the international lamb that I was purchasing at the time was coming in frozen, and it was stored in the freezer. And because of the volume of the business that I was doing there, I was maybe a case was lasting me, two, maybe 3 weeks, just because of how little lamb we were selling. And because it came in frozen, it was an easier thing to work with.
I agree, absolutely. Same when I was in production, we either got it frozen because we know that was a small portion of our menu mix in certain areas of our club, Or we would bring it in, fab it, and then blast freeze it, back it and blast freeze it ourselves. So if that had come in that way, then we would have, you know, that kind of would have just saved us some time for sure. And then we can kind of pull it when we know we need it. But I definitely think there's a market for that to be done on the front side.
Well, and I don't suspect the majority of consumers would notice a difference. I mean, and I would say by majority, I mean the great majority, 90-95%-ish.
Absolutely.
So in the food service industry, do you think that if it had a harvest date and a frozen date on the package, that would suffice that industry to say that it was put in the freezer for, you know, for the purpose of maintaining quality?
I'd be hesitant to speak on behalf of the whole industry, but most private clubs are required to have a significant menu mix, right? A wide array of proteins. Some clubs run on a cycle business, right? So they might serve lamb on Tuesdays, and that's it, right? Or they might serve lamb the third Wednesday of every month, you know? And that and literally that exists in, you know, in the club business. So I think that understanding that we need something that's a little less perishable, you know, and obviously it being frozen, it's less perishable. And it coming in, it's much easier for us to manage in-house. And if there's a way to certify or if there's a way to guarantee or even to enhance that perception of quality in a frozen product, I can't see any reason why that would be negative.
I can support that 100%. I'll give you a good example. You know, in the fish industry, fish frozen at sea is many times fresh, more fresh than that which is brought in as fresh caught, because when they process at sea, it's processed, frozen immediately. Whereas sometimes when it's caught, it may be a week old by the time it's then processed. So I mean, I've been dealing with frozen product and poultry and all different types, you know, throughout my career. And when it's done properly, there is not a problem with it at all. None.
Well, that's the goal of us and our industry, is to try to maintain that quality. And in order to do so, it may require some freezing at one point.
Yeah, I think there'll still be some facets of the market, you know, fine dining, higher end. There's bound to be some consumers that would still have a preference for that fresh lamb and would know the difference. But again, I think that's a small percentage of the market.
Yeah, absolutely. Some great content here. Thank you.
If we were all eating a little rib chop right now, it'd be even better.
Absolutely. Yeah, agree 100%.
Oh, I'll go with that. Little lollipop, without a doubt.
Love it.
So thank you so much for being here with us today, gentlemen. Gentlemen, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you. Great.
On behalf of AMCO, I would like to thank everyone for listening today.
This podcast has been recorded in association with South Bend Equipment, Winco Equipment, Colorado Mills Sunflower Oil, and is part of the AMCO American Master Chef Order.
This will be an ongoing series going forward. If you heard any topics today that you would like us to expand upon on a future episode, please feel free to contact us with questions or topics.
Please subscribe or share if any of this information has impacted you in a positive way. I'd like to thank you very much for your participation in joining us in. I invite you to stay tuned in to the AMCO podcast. Soon we'll be launching a monthly panel discussion in regards to the MasterChef exam. Looking forward to sharing more with you. Have a great day.
You can reach us at podcast@AmericanMasterChefsOrder.org. Thank you.